morning is Sweatlife against Crawford. Mr. Recko.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Attorney Bill Recko, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Brian Sweatlick. This time I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my argument for rebuttal. May it please the Court. This case involves a detective sergeant from the Manitowoc Police Department. This individual is a 25-year veteran of the police force. And at the time of the lawsuit, or the time of the events that led to the lawsuit, he was also a union steward for the Detective Bureau. That particular time, they were having difficulties with their police chief on issues involving public safety.
May I interrupt you?
Yes.
Because I'd like to try and explain what I see as a problem. Officer Sweatlick made the same remarks in the context of his work as a police officer and in the context of his leadership role in the union. The report and recommendation of the investigators does not seem to differentiate between the two contexts. It recommends discipline for the whole package of what they considered bad conduct. Does that not show that they would have disciplined him even without the union-related speech?
I don't think it does, and the reason is that the police chief is the person that's in charge of the discipline within the Manitowoc Police Department. And it was the police chief's duty under Section 6213, Sub 5 of the Wisconsin statutes to enforce his own department rules. And in this particular case, Detective Sergeant Sweatlick, on the day the phone call was made to the jail for him to release this prisoner and bring him back to the Manitowoc Police Department for a home-cooked meal, complained of that order to his deputy chief. The deputy chief at no time initiated disciplinary procedures and at no time instituted any kind of internal investigation to discipline Officer Sweatlick. At a time when the deputy chief was full aware of what the phone call was about, at a time when the deputy chief full well understood that this police chief had made the phone call and exactly the content of the phone call, and he also understood what Detective Sergeant Sweatlick had said about the phone call and why he found it offensive. At no time was there any internal investigation. And then a second event occurs before the union starts raising the issue, and that is Detective Sergeant Sweatlick then brought a complaint to the chief himself about this very phone call, claiming that the order was harassment and that he felt the chief was trying to harass him. That didn't result in any internal investigation or rules violation investigation or any kind of discipline resulting from that. It was not until the union made the speech in a list of 37 issues that it became an issue, and it was at that time that the police chief sat down with his attorney and the city mayor, and they decided to initiate an investigation whose sole objective was to have the union's 37 issues go away, because the chief and the mayor understood the 37 issues were going to create a lot of political heat for them. And it was at that time that they hired a group of attorneys to do an investigation on the 37 issues. And it's real clear that the investigation was centered on the union's 37 issues. It had nothing to do with the internal speech that Detective Sergeant Sweatlick had made complaining of the order to the deputy chief or, in fact, to the chief himself in a harassment complaint. This whole case is centered on that union speech, the 37 issues. That's the only reason these investigators were involved. That's the only.
I have a different question for you, and it's a foundational question. I don't understand what your injury is, what your client's injury is. As I understand what happened, there was a proposal made to fire him. The proposal was rejected, and he is on the force today. What's the injury?
The injury is this, Your Honor. He was charged publicly and had to go through a hearing of termination. And this was in retaliation for his free speech.
Do you know of any case that has held that a proposal to fire somebody rejected is actionable under the First Amendment? It's like saying A sued B and B responds with a suit saying that the suit itself violated the First Amendment.
Your Honor, in this particular case, though, it went a step further.
I'm not asking this particular case. My question, to repeat, was do you know of any case that holds that either a lawsuit or an administrative proposal to do something can be deemed to be the source of damages for violating the First Amendment when the proposal is rejected?
The general premise of violation of a First Amendment right, though, is the adverse action that could silence...
Counsel, the answer is yes or no.
I don't
have a case to present. If the answer is yes, I would like to know what those cases are. If it's no, I'd like to hear no.
I don't have a case to present, but
I... No. Okay.
But I do know that there's a general premises that any time the First Amendment's violated, that the very fact
so
that
you
it
would
could
expect,
silence...
If your premise is true, you would expect there would be a lot of cases establishing the proposition that, say, an unsuccessful lawsuit could be the source of damages for a violation of the First Amendment.
I wouldn't think so, and the reason I would say that is because this particular case, Your Honor...
This particular case does not answer the question why, in the entire history of American law, there is no award of damages under the First Amendment for the filing of a lawsuit or the proposal to discharge an employee.
A First Amendment lawsuit, all you have to prove is an emotional stress damage, even if it's just a $1 claim
under
to prove that the constitutional right's been violated.
Under your theory, was the investigation a violation of the First Amendment?
Under my theory, the investigation itself was a violation of the First Amendment because the investigation itself was centered on the union speech, which is protected speech.
Okay.
And it was
so public officials who get information indicating there may be a problem that's connected with that violate the First Amendment if they look into the details and cause some stress for the people who are involved?
Your Honor, this particular case had nothing to do with Mr. Swetlik's job duties at the Manitowoc Police Department.
That's not my question. The problem to follow, I'm trying to follow up on Judge Easterbrook's point, that this is really pretty unusual. What I'm frankly, your client won. Why hasn't he declared victory and gone home, gone on with his job?
A lot of reasons, Your Honor, because this particular action silenced the union, silenced the police force, silence those people who had a concern.
Silence the police force by forcing the police chief out?
The police chief was terminated because he was incompetent, and that's what the investigation found, and that was what the police officers rank and file were complaining about and got no resolution to for over a year.
Let me try to come at this. Maybe we've explored that as far as we can, but... in terms of the defense of qualified immunity here, your focus in this case is not on the investigation, but on the city council's vote to pursue formal charges.
Right.
That's the time we have to consider. And so I guess my question is, why would a reasonable alderman who has read the DeWitt report and its scathing criticism of your client, after a lot of money, a lot of hours, a lot of interviews with witnesses, why should that alderman who's read that report have understood that simply bringing the charges that would allow for an adversarial and evidentiary hearing on them would violate the First Amendment?
In fact, two aldermen did.
They didn't conclude. They did not conclude.
They
did, sir. They did not conclude that it would violate the First Amendment, and seven people went ahead with it. Why would any reasonable alderman have to conclude that it would violate the First Amendment?
And that's where we disagree. One of the aldermen specifically said because the claim had no basis in fact or law, and as he understood it, the charges were nothing about anything other than a witch hunt because 49 police officers had come to the common council to complain.
He's not giving a First Amendment opinion, and what I'm asking for you for is an explanation as to why any reasonable alderman would have to reach that conclusion after reading the DeWitt report.
There was no legal opinion rendered in the DeWitt report or by the DeWitt
attorneys. That's not the question. There was a factual report that said this man has repeatedly, deliberately lied, even when about an important matter, even when confronted with the facts.
Any reasonable public official at that point in time would have realized there was a distinction between speech made on the job and outside the job, and that the speech made outside the job could not be punished.
Is it your contention that the First Amendment protects a public employee from making deliberately false, slanderous attacks on his supervisor in public?
If it were deliberately false.
Yes.
And that's not
the case
conclusion.
Here, that's the conclusion from the DeWitt report.
First of all, First Amendment protects speech that's not truthful.
Let's talk about New York Times versus Sullivan. That's why I asked in the form deliberately false and slanderous.
And this wasn't deliberately false or slanderous based on their own finding of facts in the report.
Explain it to me.
They set forth Mr. Swetlik's speech in the charges. They set forth the allegations of what they claimed he said and did. The fact of the matter is that if you read the charges and you read the situation, you would understand they never once denied that the phone call occurred. They never once said that Mr. Swetlik had lied about the phone call, or that he lied about the fact that the chief asked him to bring this prisoner back to the police department so that the prisoner could get a home-cooked meal from his mother.
His zeal, however, has led him down a path in which he has a total and complete disregard for the truth.
Those are all conclusory statements. Where's the facts that back it? If I were a public official, I'd want to know, how did you arrive at those conclusory statements? No one asked that. No one ever asked these investigators or asked for a legal opinion, nor was any rendered. And by then, the Seventh Circuit case law was well established on First Amendment rights. The Morales case.
Forgive me, I don't understand what the best evidence is that the aldermen were retaliating because of union speech. All they had was the report of the investigating attorneys, and that report certainly didn't single out union speech. It focused on a course of comments that began outside of the union speech and ended outside of any union speech when he repeated these things to the city investigators. So what really ties the aldermen to a retaliatory intent?
They full well understood that the whole purpose of this investigation was to correct what was termed to them as morale at the police department, and that they were going to, as part of this investigation, find problems at the police department, and that the aldermen full well understood when they voted to go ahead with charges that by firing Detective Sergeant Swetlik, that was going to cure a problem at the police department. The problem was the political heat that was brought up by Detective Sergeant Swetlik and the union about the public safety issues that this chief was creating. That's what this whole thing's about. And the alderpersons full well understood that that was the situation and that they were going to move ahead with charges to silence those people. In fact, the mayor said at the very moment that they signed the charges, I'm signing the charges because this is going to stop the language from the floor to management at the police department. In other words, we are going to stop the union from complaining to management all the time and from making noise to management or about management. That's what this whole case was about. We're going to find the root of the problem, and we're going to silence it. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Redko. Mr. Gunter.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'm Greg Gunter, and I represent those government officials that are the defendant appellees in this case. Let me make it perfectly clear that none of my clients, not a single one of them, are attorneys. None of them received any advice or counsel from the city attorney during the course of all relevant facts and circumstances in this case. I want to make it also perfectly clear that the DeWitt, Ross, and Stevens law firm that was hired by the city through the city attorney was hired because of their expertise in the area of municipal law and advising governmental entities.
You know, the argument that you made in the briefs, that this wasn't a matter of public concern, is terribly difficult for me to understand. Because he's accusing the police chief of misconduct and of creating public safety hazards. How would that not be a matter of public concern? I don't see how you can recast this as some internal argument about a home-cooked meal on summary judgment.
I'm really not casting it about a home-cooked meal on summary judgment. I'll tell you how.
Could have fooled me.
Well, let me try to explain that then and straighten that out for you if there is a question about that. Detective Sergeant Swetlick, when he took part in that phone call on November 12th of 2005 and spoke to his chief, was in the course of his official duties. He was in the course of following the processes and procedures and the core facilities of his job. When he complained about the chief's statements, when he made up the two issues, the first being that the chief had told him to lie to the jailers, when he made that one up, and when he made up that the chief had threatened him, he was reporting it internally, Your Honor. He reported it to Detective Habick, who he was working with that very same day at the jail. He reported it to Deputy Chief Dick that same day under the rules of the department.
Mr. Gunta, I think you're conflating two distinct issues. I understood Judge Rovner to be asking about whether this was a matter of public concern.
Right.
There's a separate issue about whether there was speech in Swetlick's capacity as an officer or in his capacity as a citizen or, frankly, union leader here.
I see.
Could you focus on the matter of public concern issue?
Yes. I've always been a bit concerned about this whole issue of public concern because I've been in government all of my life. I think that everything that takes place in government is of public concern to the public. That's been my firm belief. But I understand that there are cases that differentiate between the words of art of public concern and under Garcetti and the like, what is public concern. I think that everything that Detective Sergeant Swetlick said and did in this case had a couple of components to it. It had his union component where he anonymously gave the information through the union that the chief had told someone on the department to lie. And I can understand that that could be a matter of public concern. But you have to take that item and you have to bring it face to face with the issue that it's not protective speech because it involves such a core function of his job to report these matters and to express his concerns internally on these matters. If he would have been subpoenaed into a deposition, for example, as in the Morales case, and would have began talking about his concerns of the chief, specifically that the chief had told him to lie and that the chief had threatened him, I can understand where that would be clearly a public concern and made on his own. But when he reports internally in the department to the chief of police himself, to the deputy chief, and to all these other law enforcement officers, that is the core, I think, of what Garcetti says is unprotected speech.
I don't disagree with you about that. The problem we have here is that Swetlick made these comments in so many different contexts.
Yes, he did.
And the initial formal complaints apparently did not generate any retaliation under the plaintiff's theory. Instead, what happened was we have it's only when things go very public with the march down to the city council and the 37, I want to say theses, but it's but the 37 issues that the union wanted to address. Frankly, that I don't see how we could say as a matter of law summary judgment was correct on that issue, given that he was that some of the key speech that seemed to provoke the investigation was in that context as a union leader.
Well, what happened, though, is when the investigators were brought in, Your Honor, and they began their investigation in November of 2006, Detective Sergeant Swetlick had his first of three interviews with them. And at that first of three interviews, Detective Sergeant Swetlick backtracked with them on his statement that he had been threatened by the chief of police in that November 12th telephone call.
By then he had the recording?
That's correct. By then he had the recording. And when he had the recording, and he knew that the investigators had the recording, he came into that first initial interview and came clean on the issue of being threatened by the use of the words, "I'll deal with you later," which were never used. That's when the investigators began keyed into Detective Sergeant Swetlick's possibility of having lied about the actual content of the conversation as it related to lying to the jailers. And that's where they followed up, and that's where they pursued that line.
I understand that. And if it was dishonest and so on, I understand your point of view on that. But I don't understand how it's not a matter of public concern, and I don't understand how it's not speech as a citizen.
Well, it's not speech as a citizen because he was
in the union charges.
In the union charges, you know, that he was never the union charge about lying.
Everybody knew that he was behind this.
Well,
right?
Everybody knew he was behind
okay.
it. We'll cut through all of that crap.
Right.
That's the truth. The fact of it is that everyone knew it was Swetlick that was behind that particular issue and several others as well.
You know, the timing is on his side, isn't it? They didn't discipline him until they started investigating the union complaints.
Well, that's not entirely. I don't think it's an issue of disciplining, Your Honor. I think it's an issue of looking into his complaints. Because you have to remember that it was briefly mentioned by counsel when he was up here, but Susan Love, an independent lawyer, was hired by the city to deal with one of these issues being that Swetlick was being harassed because he reported that the chief had lied. And she found that he was not being harassed, and that was a paid outside counsel that had come in. That was before the investigation by DeWitt Ross and Stevens. So Swetlick knew at that time that there had been an investigation, and it wasn't a cheap investigation either. It was the first of an enormous expense on this issue.
Was it more than $35,000?
Well, I can tell you, yes. It was six times that, possibly. This has been an enormous expense to the municipality, and I know that the district court saw that. I will tell you, in the qualified immunity issue, I just have to address it. I have a list of the cases that were going on here at the Seventh Circuit in a chronology of what was going on with Detective Sergeant Swetlick at the time. And I don't want to belabor it, but I can tell you that this circuit was evolving in what was of public concern and what wasn't of public concern, what was protected and wasn't protected speech. I think one of the rule that we have to should
evolving assumes progress.
Well, I think you were making progress.
So it means change.
Okay.
I think it's been clear, though. I think that we were evolving during that time period in this circuit, and to expect these people, these alder persons.
Doctrines were the fittest and survived by passing on to the next generation.
I hope that all of them are, Your Honor. I hope that. I can tell you what I think.
I don't think it's helpful to refer to law as evolving. There is no process of natural selection. The selection is decidedly unnatural.
Your Honor, I could not get away with saying that, but you certainly can. I think that the rule that Detective Sergeant Swetlick was prosecuted under, which says that officers are to tell the truth under all circumstances, whether under oath or not, is a very clear rule that he knew about.
I assume that doesn't apply to interrogations of witnesses and suspects, though, does it?
No.
So when it says all circumstances, it doesn't really mean that, does it?
No. As we know, law enforcement officers often fabricate circumstances to get results in investigations, and that has clearly been going on for a long time. You know, in the state of Wisconsin, under 6213 of the Wisconsin statutes, which is the process by which, as you all know, a police officer or a firefighter is on the road to discipline or on the road to exoneration administerially, we have a situation here where Detective Sergeant Swetlick prevailed. He won. He won. In fact, John Fuchs, the hearing examiner, said that the investigation that was made of Detective Sergeant Swetlick was, words to the effect, not only fair, but thorough and complete. I mean, that's the hearing examiner who determined that Detective Sergeant Swetlick had been threatened, had felt threatened. And under 6213 of the Wisconsin statutes, Detective Sergeant Swetlick won. He was reinstated. I will tell you that I made absolutely sure that he was paid every penny of property damage, every, including the preparation time before on duty, that he has suffered absolutely no loss. He did prevail. And as a result of that, the city sits with an enormous legal bill for someone who has won. So I think that it's, you have a, the one difficult thing I always have a problem with is this issue, again, Your Honor, of the of matter of public concern, because everything that we deal with in government is of public concern. It's just a question of, can we defer to the government entity itself in situations where there's clear proof and advice given by lawyers that there were lies stated? I think we have to defer to them on that. And under 6213, these people who signed the complaint were prosecutors. They were prosecutors. They brought the charges under 6213 sub 5.
We've never gone so far
as
to extend absolute immunity in anything, any context like this. I'd like to follow up, if I could, on the related argument. The plaintiff is trying to argue what you're really doing is an advice of counsel defense. But my understanding was that at least there's a factual issue about whether the DeWitt lawyers were in fact providing legal advice, and I don't see why your case really matters. Why that matters to your case?
I don't see it as a big matter either. But I will tell you that there's little or no doubt in the record that the DeWitt, Ross, and Stevens lawyers had two tasks. The first one was to conduct the investigation, which they did. 80 interviews and 4,200 pages of documents assembled. Then they reviewed that and did their report to the council. That was the first stage. The second stage, and the testimony of the DeWitt lawyers is very clear on this, as is the agreement, that they then were retained to advise on the charges, the drafting of the charges, and the prosecuting of the matter before the Police and Fire Commission. And I don't think that there's any doubt at all that they had a twofold task in this matter. The very initial task of the investigation, and secondarily to advise, and they testified clearly they were giving legal advice. This was legal advice that they were giving in respect to filing the charges and in respect to prosecuting the charges.
Did they actually act as prosecutors in the hearing before Mr. Fuchs?
They presented the charges. That's how it works. Any citizen can file a charge. Anybody could have filed this charge against Detective Sergeant Swetlick. The fact that the DeWitt, Ross, and Stevens was paid by the city to prosecute the charges, that is to present the charges, is a matter of record in this case as well. I think that under our Wisconsin statute, there is no law that says that people who proffer charges in front of police and fire commissions are the equivalent of prosecutors like in Imbler. I mean, there's just no law on that. But I certainly would hope that they would be entitled to a high level of prosecutorial discretion, because usually these charges are either filed by citizens, by co-workers, or by chiefs of police.
But I don't think you could name a single case where we've stretched absolute prosecutorial immunity to cover people who were simply, lodging a complaint. I don't think you're going to find such a case. And Henry,
no.
Don't go into Henry because it doesn't fit.
Oh, no, I could tell by your shaking of your head, Your Honor, that you didn't want me to go into Henry. And I understand that. And I agree with you. There just isn't. But once again, the other side of this case couldn't point to anything that limited any prosecutorial immunities to people who do file complaints under 6213 sub 5 of the Wisconsin statute. I think that if we go through a chronology of the qualified immunity issues, if you find that this was a matter of public concern, and if you take a look at it and determine that for some reason that you feel that it was a matter of public concern and that we are not entitled to what we claim is the protection of the speech, if you do look at the chronology, I'm done. Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Retko?
Thank you, Judge. May it please the Court? First of all, I'd like to address the fact that there have been a lot of First Amendment lawsuits that have gone ahead and went all the way to a verdict without a wage loss or any monetary loss. Gustafson versus Jones, Morales versus Jones, Miller versus Jones. All those cases involve police officers who were transferred to different positions to silence other people around them and themselves. The Constitution is very clear that we are trying to protect the right of free speech and those people who speak out on matters of public concern. Mr. Swalick has a claim. It's a very constitutional right that needs to be addressed and looked at, and that's why we brought the case. In regard to Mr. Gunta's comments about Mr. Swetlik at a very first interview.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.